KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to an inaugural new edition of Hearsay Culture after a summer of moving from the Stanford area to Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm very excited to have the show starting anew. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Charlotte School of Law and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University. And I welcome you to Hearsay Culture. Today we're back with a new show that will be airing on October 3rd. It's being recorded in mid to late September. But I'm very excited today to have on as my first guest recording from Charlotte, Professor James Grimmelman. James is an associate professor at New York Law School and a member of its Institute for Information Law and Policy. And we're going to be discussing several areas that James is working on, a couple of articles that he has, one called Don't Censor Search, which was recently published in the Yale Law Journal Pocket Part, and another article called Information Policy for the Library of Babel. And we're also going to be discussing virtual worlds, a topic that we've discussed on the show previously. James's background is really quite interesting. He received his JD from Yale and was editor-in-chief of LawMem and a member of the Yale Law Journal. Prior to going to law school, he received his AB in computer science from Harvard College and worked as a programmer for Microsoft. He served as a resident fellow for the Information Society Project at Yale, as a legal intern for Creative Commons and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and as a law clerk for the Honorable Marianne Trump Barry of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. His area of focus is an area of focus that we've discussed previously on Hearsay Culture and one that fits in well as we start new shows here in October, because he studies how the law governs the creation and use of computer software and how it affects distribution of wealth, power, and freedom in society. And this is an area of focus of mine a little bit, and certainly the kind of work that I've done and the work I continue to do in the trade secrecy realm focuses on the impact of trade secrecy in the public sector, but also, more specifically, the impact of trade secrecy in the software world vis-a-vis the government's use of it. And so James's work is certainly broader than that, but he says on his website, which I commend to you, at Grimmelman.net, and for those of you that may be wondering, how do you spell Grimmelman? Well, that's G-R-I-M-M-E-L-M-A-N-N. And if you go to his website, and we'll be discussing a little bit towards the end, he also says that he, as a lawyer and technologist, he quote, aims to help these two groups speak intelligibly to each other. And I think that's a critical area and something that slowly more and more people are recognizing is this the direct interchange that needs to exist between the legal community and the technology community. And indeed, even at Stanford, to the extent that one can walk from the law school over to the computer science area, it's amazing how much is going on between those two schools that are very similar, and those kinds of synergies becoming more and more apparent. So today we're going to be discussing a number of these interesting areas with James, and really just kind of having a pretty wide-ranging discussion of the nature of libraries and the internet and search engines and their role, and then the fascinating area of virtual world, something that I've been personally involved in through State of Play Academy at Stanford, but also just generally I've had to rein in my urge to run around with paint guns and there.com and focus on the work that I need to do. But having said that, it's a great area and one that I'm looking forward to exploring. So after another short music break, we will come back and start the discussion with Professor James Grimmelman of New York Law School. Well, if I have done my job properly, at the other end of the line here is Professor James Grimmelman. James, are you there?
Hello, Dave. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. Thank you. Thank you for being here on A Hearsay Culture, and as I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, I certainly thank you for being the guinea pig guest as I use my new equipment here in Charlotte for the first time. So thank you for your patience as well.
Not a problem.
Let's start right off. First of all, I gave an intro at the beginning of the show, but I think it's helpful to ask you this question. Given your background, which is quite diverse, what led you to being interested in the kind of topics that you focus on in your scholarship?
I think I really got into the kinds of things that I write about starting out as a computer scientist. So if you go back to about 2000 or so, I was working reasonably happily as a programmer. And but I sort of started to realize that the future of the internet and computer technology was going to be determined as much by lawyers as by programmers. And I think, you know, in the programming community, this really seemed like something terrible. They were going to come in not understanding the technology at all and tell us how to do our jobs and probably just destroy and ruin all sorts of wonderful new technologies. But as it was also a great time to start paying attention to law and how it was made, and Microsoft antitrust trial and Napster and the first really big denial of service attacks and huge virus. It's really interesting to think about the law and its interaction with technology. And I started reading up on things and realized that lawyers had their own distinctive and distinctive way of talking and thinking through problems that had a lot of value to it as well.
The when I think about my experience in law school, and I graduated law school in 1998, obviously the technological landscape was quite different then. And I'm curious because you graduated law school in 2005. You know, what do you make of, given the rapidly moving technology that we have and all the cliches about it, what do you make of a serendipity in our field? The idea that, you know, that so much of being involved in this stuff is being able to take advantage of being almost among the first movers to be able to look at questions. And it seems like technology law in particular favors that kind of situation. Now, you were at Yale, and Yale obviously has a number of stellar faculty that focus in this area. What do you make of that general theory?
That it's just where you are and chance connections that really expose you to the things that are going to make a huge difference in the future?
It seems not as much that, as much as just the nature of technology starting within the last 10 years. It's amazing how, as we know, how fast things move, so that theories that seemed plausible 6 months ago may not be so plausible now. And I'm just curious, I guess I'll put it another way, being in law school from, I assume, 2002 to 2005, roughly, am I right about that?
Yeah, that's my era.
Yeah, so being in law school then, what do you, if you think about your experience at that time versus what your experience might be now, or what your experience would have been a few years earlier, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think perhaps I'm a product of that era. That is, when I was in law school, I was blogging for LawMeme, which is the law and technology weblog that Yale Law School runs. And just almost out of chance, I clicked on a Slashdot story about a lawsuit against Google and about some Oklahoma search company. And it got a little attention there, but I decided there was an interesting little legal issue there. I wrote a short blog entry on it. And I got really interested in that topic, and I sort of couldn't stop returning to it every time the case moved forward a little. And that turned out for me to spark this real interest in search law, which has exploded since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're right. This is almost pure serendipity that was that particular Slashdot story and not the one above it or beneath it that drew my attention. But little things really grow to be huge, stunningly quickly. I think a lot of that is the kind of network effect that you get in the technology industry, where a few people adopt a product, and that makes other people want to flood into it, and you get things that go from nowhere to incredibly popular with astonishing speed. So YouTube's rise is the great recent story of that. And the fact that suddenly these video upload sites are now everywhere has become one of the major copyright controversies.
It's a really fascinating area, and it's one just when I when you look back on just what I thought teaching an IP survey course now, what I thought I might be teaching or focusing on an IP survey course even 2 years ago, there are so many issues right now that one could potentially anticipate, but that are really happening, point blank. It's a fascinating thing to think about, and it's certainly, I tell my students how lucky they are to be in law school right now, because technology law in particular is largely being created, and we're thinking about how we apply you know, various policies and other areas of law to the technology, and they have the opportunity to actually be part of that discussion and how unique that is to be creating an area of law. So it's an exciting area, and I think it kind of gets us into the first article that we'll discuss today, which is your article from the Yale Law Journal Pocket Park called Don't Censor Search. I mean, search is another great example of new topics that have come up in the last few years. I mean, even the debate that is existing, although maybe the decisions are being made, that really domain names are less important now because of how powerful search engines are, suggests how quickly things move. But let's start really with the basics. Your piece, Don't Censor Search, what was your focus on that?
So I wrote this for a special issue of the Yale Law Journal's online special. It's called The Pocket Part, and they publish every month a set of related essays on some topic. And this one was sparked by a controversy that's been resonating through the world of law schools on sort of this special interest to them, because it involves a discussion board originally for law students and other people applying to college and professional schools called autoadmit.com.
Mm-hmm.
And through one thing and another, some of those message boards became very attractive to people who liked to post anonymous and quite hateful things about various female students. So these incredibly misogynistic comments about their physical appearance, just bald-faced lies about their sexual history, and all sorts of unflattering and probably legally actionable things. And so in the ordinary course of events, lawyers tend to think that when somebody says blatantly false, harmful things about somebody else, well, you sue them. And in this case, because the posters were anonymous, that didn't seem to be such a possible option. So eventually, a group of law students were acting anonymously, filed a John Doe suit, I guess a Jane Doe lawsuit,
right,
both against a bunch of unnamed posters and also against the operators of the site, hoping that they would, by this technique, be able to get at identifying information, learn what IP addresses or where these people who posted these things were, so they could be tracked down and sued in their own names. And I got interested in the topic in particular because it requires this sort of search engine angle. I've written about search engines in some other places, and I'm thinking about them ever since I blogged about Google lawsuits in 2002. Because if you think that you can't sue the posters individually, and you think that you may not have success suing the message board operators, because there's a federal statute, Section 230, that basically immunizes people who just run Internet services, like message boards or your local ISP, from liability for the stuff that flows through their pipes. So if you think you can't sue the posters and you can't sue the message board operator, maybe you could resolve the problem by going to search engines.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you think, if you're going to search on Jane Law student's name in Google, then the real problem for her is not that a few spiteful people are off in some message board discussing her. It's that people who search on her name, like prospective employers, get directed to the vitriol. And so from her perspective, if Google were just to direct searchers on her name somewhere else, most of the problem would go away. And so there are a bunch of proposals to, in some ways, give search engines legal duties to prevent harms like that. And my essay is a response to that, saying it's an attractive idea, but there are better ways to confront the problem.
The debate about search engine regulation kind of opens up a lot of theoretical questions about the nature of the internet, and you get into them a bit in your piece, and I think it's worthy to discuss them. Starting with the basic idea, putting aside the regulation of companies generally, that of course exists, and securities regulations and what have you, focusing specifically on specific regulations that would relate directly to the operation of search engines. The first broad question is, do you think it's a good idea from a very basic standpoint to have external rules apply to the operation of a search engine?
I'm not sure that I feel that we set any search special rules, but I'm not generally in favor of giving search engines too many carve-outs from otherwise applicable ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things about search is that almost anything on the internet is a search engine, has a search engine built into it, or depends upon search engines to be useful. And so if you had a search engine carve-out or search engine exemption, then you get a situation where everybody just claims, I'm a search engine. I'm not really a video host. In fact, I'm a search engine. I'm not really a file-sharing network. I'm a search engine. And you create this category of sort of an excuse for every technology to try and cram itself into to avoid other responsibilities.
When you're dealing with issues like the auto-admit situation, which was obviously, you know, offensive to any decent person, we get into these issues of carving out information, and it's something that you also discuss in your piece. So I guess, turning to in that direction, we have information, you know, related to the auto-admit scandal that is clearly information that's repugnant and not the kind of stuff we want to see, and yet it's out there. Is when we talk about making information unfindable, do you think that that's something that that generally we should be doing?
I'm not in favor of that. My general attitude towards information in the internet is to push as many things out there and just not worry about the organization or the quality, just make them available. And then to develop tools like search engines and tagging systems and social networks that do collaborative filtering to help people sort through it. You get this attitude when it comes to open access publishing, where rather than hiding things behind paywalls, if they're made freely available, the increased circulation speeds them up by so much that you more than make up for the losses of trying to control them. It's the open source software instinct.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one of the great lessons of search tools, is that something like Google works because there are huge, huge mountains of information that it can use to test and refine algorithms. And this works in some sense because the tendency of the age is towards publishing more and more. And so if something is false, it's hurtful, and people don't want to be exposed to it because they don't want lies about people, then it's very much in the interest of people building good search tools to find ways of harnessing the internet's knowledge that these materials are false or damaging and people don't want to see them.
Is this analogous in your view to the traditional First Amendment analysis that likens speech to safety valves?
In what sense?
In the sense that by allowing people to put their information out there on the internet, and indeed not just put it out there, but allow it to be findable by way of search engines, that you diffuse worse or other reactions that we don't want from a social perspective.
And I think there's a nice strain of the argument that the best remedy for bad speech is more speech. And there's a real concern that the more speech can't erase the ill effects of the bad speech. But I tend to think of search and other information filters as things that really help us decide for ourselves which speech is valuable and which isn't.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned at all about the permanence of speech on the internet? That is, that, you know, extending this analogy a little bit, the traditional, person yelling in the town square is likely not being recorded, and his or her words are heard by whoever hears them. Maybe there's a reporter there, but basically, for purposes of what that particular individual is doing, his or herself, the information is simply being put out into the ether, as it were. Whereas the internet, as we know, has a permanence to it. Does that at all change your analysis with respect to how much information should be searchable through a search engine?
This is a tough problem. I tend to, again, following my original instincts, I think that the permanence of the internet is, in one sense, an incredible virtue because it makes complete archiving possible, and things that are lost to history from earlier eras need not be lost today. But, as you point out, this has a real counter effect on personal values of dignity and privacy. Because now people are, in some sense, more locked into the internet identities they've assumed at earlier ages,
mm-hmm.
and it's more easy to, in some sense, permanently brand someone by putting up something that is going to follow them as long as the internet continues to exist. So sometimes I bemoan that because it feels like there are these pressures that will take things out of the perfect archive, and people will be going and trying to burn down our new Library of Alexandria. But at the same time, we have to find ways of accommodating that tendency to the need for a space for autonomy, for individuality, for change in who you are. And where we'll find these new private spaces is a tough, difficult question.
Yeah. And it's one that kind of gets us also to the relative responsibilities of the various players that enter into the operation of a search engine. A search engine, of course, at its core is a tool. The engine itself is not necessarily creating the information as much as it is organizing it. And your piece and indeed other guests, in fact, Alex Wright, who's going to be on the show discussing his book Glut and various others, Peter Morville's Ambient Findability, various guests on Hearsay Culture have talked about the challenges attendant to organizing and collating the information that's out there. And you talk about this again a little bit in your article, and I kind of want to probe you on it. Where does the site owner play in your analysis?
Well, I mean, I take a pretty strong position, which is I think search engines are tools of the people who use search, and that's the right place. That search helps them make sense of the overwhelming fact of our day, which is informational abundance. And that is a massive, massive public good. And in that, I'm comparatively indifferent to the perspective of people who are information providers. That is, they're providing a valuable function. But as the total volume of information grows, the interests of any individual offerer of information become less and less significant. So, for example, I think of things like the Authors Guild suit against Google in relation to the book search project, or many of the European publishers' suits against the search engines for basically telling them not to index their news. I see these as, in some ways, attempts to take away from the public information that circulates in the public realm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an attempt to do things that cripple the informational universe and make it harder for individuals to sort out what's going on and where the information they need to live fulfilling lives is.
The before we take a short break and move into other great areas, and I think we could probably spend a whole show on thinking about search engines, but I do want to ask you this. In terms of where we're headed, this is one of the unfair questions, probably the main unfair question that I ask of my guests. I occasionally ask them to pull out the crystal ball. So if you don't mind being a prognosticator of sorts, if you're looking 5 years from now, let's say, to search engines themselves in whatever form they will be, what's your prediction with regard to regulation of them? Do you expect to see more or less or different, or what would be your best educated guess at this point?
My best educated guess is that search engines will fight off almost all restrictions on how they index and where they have to rank sites, but that law enforcement and government are going to impose on them quite stringent data retention records so that the data that they keep on their users will be used in privacy-invading ways.
And hopefully Hearsay Culture is going strong 5 years from now, and perhaps 5 years from now I can invite you back and we can see where we are. So I'll look forward to that, assuming that you agree. And let's take a short break at this point. You're listening to KZSU-FM and Hearsay Culture with Professor James Grimmelman. So we're going to take a short music break and then continue the conversation. Before we return to the conversation with Professor James Grimmelman from New York Law School, now's the time on Hearsay Culture, and this doesn't change one bit, even though I'm recording 3,000 miles roughly from KZSU's home studios, to say that KZSU KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you in order to keep its diverse programming going. If you're interested in learning more about making a donation, or indeed if you'd like to make a donation, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture and that you keep listening generally to KZSU. So we're back with Professor James Grohman. And James, let's turn to your piece, Information Policy for the Library of Babylon. This is a fascinating really a great article and really very probative, and I very much enjoyed reading it. Why don't you, for the benefit of the listeners, tell us a little bit about what this piece is about.
Okay, so I took as inspiration the great, wonderful, classic Borges short story, The Library of Babel. And it's hard to call it a story because it has almost no plot as such, but it's a rumination about life in an infinitely large library. The library, which some call the universe, is composed of an infinite number of hexagonal galleries. And he goes on to describe it, that each of these rooms has a series of bookshelves on it, and each of the bookshelves has a certain number of books, each has the same number of pages. And then if you go up or down the staircase from each one, you come to another room, and another, and another. And it becomes a metaphor for the world, the universe, and the search for any kind of knowledge in the library is a little bit like man's search for God and for meaning in life. You can look around it, and most of the books are complete gibberish. And then one of them repeats the letters MCV over and over and over. He mentions that his father once saw a book that was nonsense, except for the single line, O time thy pyramids. And he talks about the different kinds of cults and beliefs that have arisen about the nature of the library and what people should do living their lives in it. And this is this wonderful metaphor about a library that contains every possible book, not just all the ones that have been written, but the ones that will be written and the ones that could be written. So it contains all human knowledge and more within it. But no one knows where any of it is because the books are in absolutely no sensible order. And people picked up on this metaphor, the idea that this incredibly large, incredibly disorganized collection of knowledge maps naturally onto the internet. So I wrote a sort of a cute little piece about what we would do if we took this metaphor really seriously. Suppose we were working for the Federal Library Commission. We were asked to come up with sensible information policy. Now, how would we make the library useful to its residents?
The world of library science and libraries generally, obviously, is another tumultuous area and has been impacted, depending on the librarian for better or for worse, by technology. And I guess we're talking about a short story that was published in 1941 and that has an enormous amount of resonance today. Now, you take this short story and you translate some of its precepts into a application of rules for the internet. So talk about some of those rules.
Okay. One of the ones that I start with, and so the earlier ones, is that infrastructure matters. That Borges strews the story with little hints about how the physical infrastructure of the library is starting to decay. There are staircases that are out. The lights aren't as good as they could be. People are all complaining about the adequacy of the facilities. And there's a suggestion that, in fact, there might be some books usefully on certain shelves, but it's becoming increasingly hard to get to them. And I think that this is something really important about the internet, which is that all of the informational resources on it depend upon this substrate of having computers, having people have access to them, having the connectivity and the backbone there to support it, having people have the education they need to be intelligent users and consumers of information online. So that one of the things that's really fundamental to any information policy is just giving people the support they need to be able to make sense out of the resources. You know, a great library is of no use if no one can get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of take building upon the vastness of the library and the disorganization, I move to the idea that search is really the key to making it useful. And this fits very nicely with my emphasis on search engine laws, why I really love this story as a metaphor.
Right.
The idea is, if we had some tool that would actually let us find a book from some partial description of it, if we could query with a few words and find books that were roughly on that topic, the usability of the library would be improved immensely. It would jump from being a frustrating informational desert into the real paradise of useful information that it could be. And I picked up on one little hint of this in the story, and I expand it beyond all reason. But Borges talks a bit about a quasi-mythical figure called the Bookman. The Bookman is somebody who has, while wandering through the library and its infinite stacks, stumbled across the one book that is the index and compendium of everything else in the library. It's a book that perfectly makes sense of the whole library. And, you know, he doesn't have access to it anymore, but what he remembers of it is still going to be immensely valuable. And so I sort of spin out this fantasy that, in fact, we can start asking him questions, and he'll direct us to particular hexagons and to particular books within them, and we can start to use that knowledge to really make proper use out of the library.
Taking a very abstract piece and bringing it down to something more concrete like the internet is a bit of a challenge, and I think you've done a good job in this piece doing that. One of the points you make is in part of your general analysis of the volume of information that exists on the internet is what people would do with what you call junk results. And I guess I want to probe that a little bit too. You say in the piece that people will recognize junk results and therefore discard them, but I guess that, you know, begs the question of really how do people make the determination that the results are junk if the information that they're getting is bombarding them with every possible perspective. At some point, you need to be able to take a step back and draw on other experiences other than those that you may have derived by merely reading or ascertaining information on the internet. What do you make of that statement? Do you agree, or is there something I'm missing with that?
Well, you've just stated the fundamental antinomy that people think of when they think of hermeneutics. The idea is you can't possibly make sense of new information because a genuinely new concept has to be explained and interpreted in light of your existing knowledge, and therefore new knowledge acquisition is impossible. It's a kind of Zeno's paradox of learning.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, we do build new mental conceptions all the time, and though we may not have absorbed the idea as it was intended to be absorbed by us, we've built an image of it nonetheless. And then in terms of Borges, one of the things that is striking is that this is a library with no authors.
Right.
It is the books are on the shelves, but there's no attribution, and they're not the work of any individual creative spirit. So in fact, this is a modern literary criticism, also loves this story because it's a perfect metaphor for the interpretation of text, that any meaning of any book is brought to it by the reader and not reflecting any author's intent. So, in some sense, when we find things on the internet and we try to make sense of them the best we can, we are working from within our own existing perspective, and we may not understand that information in the way it was meant to be understood, but I certainly think a lot of people today would feel quite comfortable saying, oh yeah, I went on the internet and I learned this.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact that it's only information from the internet doesn't mean that it's worthless or that we're not actually learning something.
The world that Borges develops in this piece sounds, as you point out, both thrilling and also terrifying. And as I was reading through and reflecting on it, you know, it reminded me of books like Kafka's The Castle and others where individuals are fighting or trying to somehow get something from a massive bureaucracy. And in that sense, you know, getting back to the search engine idea, the search engine is an enormous tool to allow individuals to not have this vast quantity of information crush them. But are there others? Can we learn anything from your connection of Borges' work to the internet about the nature of the individual user to the internet generally?
What Borges would say would be, I think, that the internet itself as a thing is utterly indifferent towards us. That to even ask whether the internet has our interests at heart is to attribute human qualities to something that is vast and incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's that Kafkaesque sense of frustration before something incredibly large and incredibly confusing, it captures something very real about the sense of the overwhelming sense that I think a lot of us in our generation have at some time or other felt seeing the vastness of the internet. I wonder whether people who are younger than us have simply grown up with it all their lives and in some sense take that vastness for granted, that it's not a shock of coming into contact with it. And I wonder whether some future expansion of it, some new exponential increase in what's available and its disorganization might have the power to shock them, or if there's only one Rubicon we can only cross once.
It is a fascinating question, and it's one that I've grappled with directly with the birth of my son and seeing the world that he's entering. The fact that I'm handing him to take a look at cell phones that allow me to communicate by way of text as well as telephone and mobile and have internet access on them. And I bought a device that I can hook up to my computer that turns the keyboard into kind of a computer that a 9-month-old or a 1-year-old would understand. And it really is an amazing thing to think that my son will not know a world where this access isn't at his fingertips. And I also it makes me wonder whether to him this will not seem quite as vast or even quite as daunting as it does to us who are by the scheme of the world, we're not at all a different age, but, talking, 25, 35 years older than him, it raises the issue of the world that he is entering and the kind of things that he'll take for granted. And it's a fascinating area, and I've actually indulged it a little bit on my website by posting an occasional picture of Noah. But it's something that I guess leads me to a final question on this piece before we turn quickly to virtual worlds, which is, what do you think generally Borges' story can tell us or teach us about the nature of internet regulation?
So I draw from it a couple of slightly conflicting thoughts about search tools, because I think those remain the key to making the internet useful. So on the one hand, we are really, in a substantial sense, at the mercy of any given tool, because if a tool has good knowledge and chooses to withhold it from us, we don't have good ways of checking up on that. We simply don't know about the sites that a search engine has chosen to bury. And that's an anxiety that a lot of people who think about search engine law feel, the sense that there's this kind of hand manipulation of results, that Google could take somebody, a flower shop who doesn't choose to advertise with it, and just punish them by burying it. Or, Google employees could punish their exes by banishing them way down in the search results. But at the same time, if you have multiple search engines, then they act as a kind of check on each other. Because if something, you're not getting good information one way, you can turn to another tool, and you can easily see if there's a really good result on one engine that the other engine is hiding. So the more search engines we have, and the more diverse the ways that they work are, the better.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, I'm most optimistic about not competition among search engines so much as competition among search technologies, that the centralized search engine that indexes and sorts and recommends exists alongside with tag clouds, with social networks, with other forms of organizing information that operate in very, very dissimilar ways. And I think that's probably encouraging that kind of deep competition among different kinds of technologies is probably the healthiest thing that internet regulation can do for search.
Let's turn quickly in the remaining about 7 minutes that we have to talk about virtual worlds. And I think in this spectrum, and given the time we have, I kind of want to ask you this broad question, which is, what are you focusing on right now as you think about the nature of virtual worlds and again, their impact on society generally?
Okay, so I study virtual worlds, places like Second Life or World of Warcraft, these multi-person online environments that that use the visual metaphor, that you and other players are together in some space. I focus on them because you can get a lot of really interesting questions by asking what would happen if we took these places seriously as real places with their own legal systems. And some people take that question to mean, okay, how should the real-life legal system, our courts and our legislatures here in the real world, relate to those so-called laws online? Should we defer to them? Should we override them? But there are also very interesting questions of what can we learn about how law emerges in society by seeing how player groups and players and designers create new institutions to resolve disputes and to provide governance. We can learn things about the basics of property and crime and tort by watching how people develop new rule sets to govern themselves and seeing what those rule sets do well and where people complain about them.
The nature of virtual worlds is one that even among people that think they're familiar with computers and are familiar with computers, they're still kind of perplexed by what they are. So maybe, you know, I've asked this question of a few people. I'm always curious to see how people react to it. How do you define a virtual world? What would be your core basic definition of it?
It's a shared space. It is persistent for at least a few minutes, and it presents, it's online, and it presents the metaphor of some physical embodied space.
The nature of virtual worlds leads to this issue, which I always find interesting, which is how people choose to represent themselves vis-a-vis their avatar. So perhaps I'd ask you to define avatar for the benefit of the listeners and then look at it from the perspective of, does the nature of the avatar or the interface that the individual human being uses with the in the virtual world affect its regulation?
Okay, so an avatar, and I'm going to tip off into etymology because it's fun. this comes from this idea in Hindu mythology that Vishnu has multiple avatars. This is God who incarnates or descends into or appears within the world in different forms, as the hero Rama, as a giant fish, as various other forms throughout history. And so the avatar is this embodiment of a more transcendent existing entity within the space and becomes both real and divine. So that when we go into a virtual world, in this physical space, we choose a character to represent ourselves. This character has an appearance. It has a certain kind of face. It has certain clothing, maybe have wings. It might be a kind of an animal. It might be a machine. It might be a cloud. But it's some physical representation of the player behind it, or the means by which the player interacts with the world. And so you get questions about what's the relationship of the personality of the avatar to the personality of the player. And I think the really interesting stuff there has to do with privacy. Because you're creating this alternate identity. And you can see that there are privacy issues in both directions. Tal Zarsky wrote a very nice paper pointing out that if you're a construction worker and you play a Jedi in Star Wars Galaxies, it could be embarrassing to you in the game for people to learn that you're a construction worker.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be embarrassing to you among your friends who are also construction workers to learn that you play this computer game. And so there's this separate identity, and there becomes a privacy interest in you having the control over whether that identity is linked back to you. And this is especially a problem because virtual worlds, being software-mediated where everything is run on a computer, just by their nature can be surveillance states.
Mm-hmm.
That is, people who run the game can monitor everything that happens, every word someone says, everywhere they go, everything they pick up, everything they see can be recorded for later analysis. So that just by its nature, the virtual world can be a near-perfect panopticon. And what does it mean when you have your basic daily activities inside a virtual world subject to this kind of continual tracking?
Right. And it leads us, you know, unfortunately, given the nature of a one-hour show, I run into this with virtually every guest, no pun intended, when I say that the time just doesn't allow us to get into all of these issues. And I think what I'll do is I'll ask you this final question before we sum up, which is, again, the crystal ball question. Virtual worlds still seem, at least to people of our age and older, fairly abstract and almost diversions from quote-unquote real life. Do you see virtual worlds more and more intertwining with what we know as real life today as time progresses?
Yes. This is overwhelmingly the point that the really sharp sociological and anthropological scholars make when they talk about virtual worlds, which is that people who play in them mediate this virtual and real existence, and the two overlap. They are simultaneously in both places, and they really integrate their virtual experiences into their identity, and it becomes something that's an extension of their offline life rather than a separate escape from it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people right now are most used to thinking about things like games, World of Warcraft, or first-person shooters, that you go into this as an escapist game that has little to do with your real life. But I'm guessing 5 years from now that there'll be, you know, several virtual worlds that people are starting to accept as being just part of their life, part of their daily activities, in the same unproblematic way we now think of the web.
Hmm.
That is, it's something that simply becomes so commonplace and so routine that you don't have an alien sense of necessarily going someplace else when you go into the virtual world to interact. It's just part of how you meet up with your friends, how you shop, how you do various things that are related to what you would do offline, but different in a few ways.
With that, James, unfortunately, we do have to close. I do want to first thank you for being on Hearsay Culture and for taking the time today to get into some of your work. And I know that this is only some of the many publications you have. For those that want to learn more about this area, do you have any recommendations, learning about more about these topics or about your work?
I would say, of course, I'll direct people to go to my own website to find out more from my papers, james.rimmelman.net. I put almost everything I can up there because I'm a big believer in open access publishing, just that sharing the knowledge and making these things available for free download by anyone who's interested.
Terrific. Well, James, thanks again for being on the show. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a great pleasure.
I want to thank James Grimmelman again for being on the show and for really getting into some fascinating areas with respect to virtual worlds, search engines, and indeed the nature of libraries. I'm looking forward to having on a number of guests over the coming several shows that focus in this area. Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut, focusing on the nature of libraries, as well as John Walensky from Stanford, who's written a terrific book called The Access Principle. I'll also be speaking to other scholars in areas including trademark law and Dan Solove, who has a new book coming out on digital worlds generally, and Eric Davis, who will be a return guest on the show, who's going to be discussing the fascinating question of how it is that California developed this mystic culture and how that mystic culture directly relates to the development of technology. So Hearsay Culture, as you know, is a show that you can hear live on KZSU, and indeed I recommend that you do that, because then you get the opportunity to listen to the music that does not make it to the podcast. But if you listen to the podcast, you do have several options in getting the podcast. You can go to hearsayculture.com, where you will find all of the shows, and I post them as quickly as I can after they are aired. And the show is aired generally Wednesdays from 5 to 6 Pacific Standard Time on KZSU. You can also find the show by going to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford. And that's, if you haven't found that page, you can type Center for Internet and Society in the search engine in iTunes and find it. And lastly, you can also get the show through the podcast feed on CIS's webpage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So thank you again for listening. I hope you enjoyed the program. I do encourage you to email me with any comments or questions or suggestions for future guests, and you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Otherwise, thanks again, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.